Rewiring Your Life with Erica Spiegelman and Marcia Stone. Wellness, inspiration, support.
Welcome to Rewiring Your Life. My name is Erica Spiegelman, and
Marcia
my
Stone.
Beautiful, wonderful co-host is here with me today. And we pride ourselves on sharing with our audience inspiration, wellness tips, and support. We have on guests that, you know, are visionaries and amazing human beings that are changing the world in terms of health and wellness and academia and health and nutrition. And so we've had this on so many kinds of guests. And today we have another incredible woman with us, Dr. Danielle Dick. She is a tenured professor of psychiatry at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, where she serves as the inaugural director of Rutgers Addiction Research Center and holds the Greg Brown Endowed Chair in Neuroscience. She's also an internationally recognized and award-winning expert on genetic and environmental influences on the human behavior. She's contributed to more than 20 grants, which I found so incredible because I know grant funding is hard to get.
Incredible.
Yeah, and she's also had 350 peer-reviewed publications in the areas of child development, addiction, mental health, genetics, and human behavior, and won numerous awards for her work. So welcome, Danielle, to the show. I cannot believe you do look so young and you've done all
incredible.
These things. Can you tell us a little bit about, tell us a little bit about the center and the work that you're focusing on?
Well, thank you all so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Yes, I am a newcomer to Rutgers. I just joined the end of January.
Oh, congratulations.
And really what brought me to New Jersey and to this position was the tremendous opportunity that I see. And so Rutgers is an amazing place in the sense of having multiple campuses, multiple medical schools, an extensive hospital and behavioral care system. And there's amazing research going on in the addiction space there. But it's really right now spread out across all these campuses and these medical centers. And so what I'm going to be doing is really working to strategically bring together the researchers who are working on tackling addiction from a variety of different angles. And so everything from basic science, neuroscientists, geneticists, epidemiologists trying to understand risk and protective factors, to individuals who are working on prevention and intervention, treatment and recovery, public policy. And the idea is really to create more of a community and to create more collaboration so that we can further grow our research in this space and make discoveries that we can then translate to the community, and ultimately with the goal of improving human lives and reducing the burden of addiction.
Amazing. I don't know if you know this about us, Danielle. I mean, Marcia could tell you a little bit about herself, but I'm a drug and alcohol counselor certified. You know, that's my certification, but I have a private practice and some books that have been published on recovery and rewiring your brain. And, but based on the foundation of self-love, self-care, and how our pathways can really change with repetition in terms of routine and practice and stuff like that. So we both are familiar with this. Marcia, do you want to tell her a little bit about what you've done in this addiction world?
Well, I am the CEO and founder of BRC Behavioral Healthcare in Austin, Texas. And we're four different treatment centers here in Austin. I've been in recovery myself for a long time. And, you know, I'm just fascinated by your work because, you know, I was just telling someone this morning that, you know, growing up, we didn't talk about alcoholism and addiction in our family, even though, you know, generations, you know, were just littered across the whole family tree. And I think a lot of families are actually like that. And I love that you're talking about the genetic predisposition. I certainly don't want to, you know, misspeak about what you're saying, but, you know, I haven't read all the work that you've done yet. But is that the direction? Because that's fascinating to me.
Yes. Well, firstly, thank you both for your amazing work in this space. It obviously takes many of us to make a difference in this huge problem, right? We're all affected in one way or another, whether it's personally or through family members, neighbors, workers, other loved ones. And so my own personal research, as you mentioned, is in the area of genetic and environmental influences on substance use disorders and related outcomes. And so one of the things that we know is we're not all equally at risk. We're all at risk for something. You know, our DNA always carries some things that are not perfect. None of us is perfect. And but some of us are more at risk for cardiovascular diseases or for diabetes, and other individuals are more at risk for substance use problems or other kinds of psychiatric outcomes. And so I do think one of the, you know, really tremendous developments that's happened over the last decade or so is to see people talking about that more, you know, to reduce some of the stigma. And the more we talk about it, the more we reduce the stigma, because it does affect all of us. And the more we talk about it, the more that we can make a difference in this space.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You know, I wanted to jump to some of the work you do with children, and how I was explaining to my husband last night that you're coming on, and he's a scientist himself, but they do memory care, you know, drugs. They're trying to get drugs for Alzheimer's and dementia. But I was just saying how it's so interesting that you were saying if like a child is outgoing and that they, you know, like they're different personality types, and if they are around a lot of older people and they have a lot of like socialization around them, then they're going to be more prone probably to like a teacher in class, and then they'll probably sit in the front of the class, and then they'll probably do better because they have more attention, and then that leads to more self-esteem, which leads to the next part of their life. And so again, these stages of how like our environment and our genetic disposition come together in so many ways that affect our lives like tenfold. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Did I summarize it up a little like well enough? Or?
You did. Okay, absolutely. Okay. You did a beautiful job.
Sorry. So, I just read a little bit about it, but that was one little piece. Yeah.
Well, you nailed it. Because really the key points are that, you know, genes are important, our environments are important, but they're also related in really interesting ways. And so, you know, I started out being interested in genetics of substance use disorders, so why some individuals are more at risk than others. And interestingly, it turns out a lot of people now understand that genes, our genes influence our risk for addiction and other kinds of substance use outcomes. But, you know, I find that a misconception is that what that means is that the way we are going to physiologically respond to a drug makes some people more likely to become addicted or dependent on it than others. And certainly there's a little truth to that. So obviously our genes do influence a little bit of our biology and metabolism of a drug. But actually, the biggest ways that our genes influence our risk for substance use disorders is via these other two big pathways that we talk about sometimes as, you know, the reward seeking or more impulsivity kind of pathway. So some of us have brains that are wired to be more sensation seeking, more primed toward that, you know, that dopamine hit. And other individuals.
Me and Marcia are like, yes, yes, we agree. Yeah.
Yes, that's us.
And then,
good thing we didn't know each other back
in
the day, Erica.
Some of us are more prone toward anxiety sensitivity and toward worry. And of course, you know, we can be high, middle, or low on both of these dimensions. And of course, I'm oversimplifying. There's different facets of these dimensions. But what we know is that individuals who are, you know, more sensation-seeking, more impulsive, are more likely to try substances when, you know, they enter the environment, usually in adolescence, and they're more likely to use in riskier ways, and that can then lead to potentially developing problems. And, you know, on the other hand, individuals who are more prone toward, you know, worry, toward anxiety, that what we find is that over time, and it tends to be a later onset, but if you don't learn coping skills, right, and there aren't environmental interventions to help with that, that using substances can start to become a way to cope. And the piece that I find most interesting, yes, about studying genetics, and one of the reasons our genes are so important is that, you know, these temperaments show up really early in life. So if anybody's had, you know, more than one child, you realize they're really different from the very beginning. You're doing the same thing and they're turning out really different. And so that, you know, and then as you were alluding to before, these sort of temperamental traits. So the, you know, child who is more impulsive, now as they get older, they're seeking out other kinds of impulsive friends.
People,
those
right.
Friends mm-hmm. are then mm-hmm. further feeding back into the high-risk behavior. And
so,
you know,
yeah,
it
yeah.
can create these yeah. feedback loops between our dispositions and our environments.
It's so true. It's so, so true. I mean, I think too, you know, for myself being when I was first starting to drink or trying smoking, you know, cigarettes or whatever it was, 13, 14, definitely was attuning to other kids that were, my parents were divorced. I didn't have a lot of supervision at the time. They also didn't have supervision, you know, so it's, you attune to the same kind of people, which creates normalcy. And then that, you know, further, like, you know, you could be in denial that this is really not bad. Everyone's doing it, you know, and all these other things. There's so many layers to how people become. I mean, and I'll have people ask me this for decades. I'm sure, Marcia, you've been asked this too. I have families that call me and say, how did this happen? It's like, there's no one
yes.
thing to point at. This is so multi-layered.
Right.
This is you're just saying, Danielle, that there's just so many factors that come into this.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I find so fascinating about doing work in this area, is that no one wakes up one morning to discover, oh my gosh, I had an onset of alcohol use disorder, right? Or like, I am suddenly addicted to opioids, right? It doesn't just happen one morning out of the blue. It is these kind of pathways, you know, these unfolding risk pathways that are found, and they're different for every individual, right? It's, you know, partly our dispositions. It's partly, you hit on a big one. It's access to substances, and it's how much monitoring there is when you're an adolescent. And so I actually just talked to a group of parents earlier this week and was saying, you know, the number one thing parents can do is reduce access, right, by monitoring your kids. Because the longer we can kind of, you know, delay onset of use of substances, the better we know it is for their developing brain.
No, I'm just curious really quick about just the narrative too of just like, you know, if you watch your parents betray themselves, like by drinking, like my father, you know, drank a lot when I was growing up, or I wouldn't say a lot, but it was in the house every day. It was something I saw. It was something that was normal. And so I'm just curious too, those narratives that come into play as well. Of just, you know, what is normal, what you see, you know, what is mirrored to you also probably has a huge influence on you. Don't you think that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I was just reading something very interesting, you know, yesterday that was talking about, you know, when you're a child, you really don't have access to the bigger picture, meaning what you see in your family, you think all families are like that, right? It takes a while to realize actually families can be very different, right? And I think all of us can fall into that trap. I still have a tendency to default into imagining that all of my friends grew up in families just like mine, which of course is not at all true. And as you were mentioning, especially kids who are growing up in families where their parents have substance use problems, oftentimes they're getting a double whammy of they oftentimes have inherited their own increased mm-hmm. genetic risk,
mm-hmm. right, right.
but they also are oftentimes in environments where there might be increased exposure to trauma as a result of parents who, you know, are not around as much and having their own challenges and
right.
maybe
mm-hmm.
not as able to, you know, monitor and care for their kids and be as attuned to their needs. And so it can, you know, it can unfortunately create this double whammy effect of both genetic and environmental risk that some kids inherit.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you said at the beginning, you were talking about the stigma of alcoholism and drug addiction. And, you know, I just wanted to ask, well, first of all, I agree with you that over the last 10 or 15 years, more and more people are more open about their recovery. And it just seems to be that there's, you know, more acceptance of, you know, a medical, you know, diagnosis for alcoholism and substance use disorder, rather than, you know, kind of being a moral failure, which was, you know, kind of the way it was, you know,
yes.
labeled on, you know, us. I don't know about you, Erica, but that was sort of, you know, that's the way it felt to
how
me when
felt.
I was, you know,
yeah.
yeah, getting, you know, like in trouble. I was a lawyer and I was getting in trouble with the Bar Association and, you know, it was definitely, you know, more punitive than rehabilitative. But anyway, you know, that's all right. I mean, everything worked out well. But, you know, what do you think the future is for, you know, for people? Because it just seems that it's just such a huge, huge problem and people are in so much pain. And, you know, what's the future?
I am constantly encouraged by the positive developments that I see in along the lines of the very kind of thing that you were talking about, that there is recognition that people who, you know, let's be honest, sometimes you're getting into trouble, right? Like it's interfering with your work performance or your living situation or your relationships. And historically, that was met with, you know, you're a bad person. Why can't you get your life together? Why can't you stop using?
You're like, I don't
that
know.
Narrative. Yes, exactly. And all that does is further feed, right. You know, the yeah. addiction. Because
the shame.
It's like, I'm trying.
Yes,
right?
Yes,
exactly.
Yes. Because you're trying and then you go into hiding.
Yes. And, you know, and then obviously when you have that pain, you tend to use the substances to cope further. And I'm increasingly seeing across multiple different industries, right, in the business world, in universities, et cetera, that there is increased recognition that individuals who are struggling with substance use disorders need our help, not our judgment or punishment. That essentially should trigger how do you get this individual help rather than, you know, I'm going to punish this individual or get them out of my organization or, you know, the kinds of things that historically happened. And, you know, at universities, we're changing, you know, many times are in many cases, the rules surrounding alcohol and other drug use so that rather than being met with punishment, it's met with, you know, here are ways that we can help you, you know, get help. And I think you're seeing this increasing. I was actually talking with a reporter just last week who was talking about the fishing industry and how, you know, it now is, you know, boats are carrying naloxone and they're essentially realizing this is a problem. We need to help people rather than we need to, you know, meet this with a...
They're carrying the naltrexone shots?
With judgment and punishment.
Yeah.
Yes,
oh
exactly.
Wow, crazy.
There's a variety of you know, really positive developments that I'm hearing about on a regular basis now. Even in my husband's own business, he talks about how he runs a business, and so they have a number of people who are working in the warehouse and other kinds of things where, you know, he's seen individuals who struggling with substance use, and now their policy is really how do we help these individuals as opposed to like, oh, you came with a positive drug test, you're out, right? And I'm sure that's partly from having a wife in this field, but I think it's also, it reflects, you know, the changing attitudes towards substance use. And I hope that trend will just continue on.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny. As you're saying that, I was going to pivot to like what you published specifically on the topic of parenting, but it's just like with kids. I have a 2 and a 3-year-old. I have 2 toddlers, and it's like if they
so cute, by the way.
Thank you, Marcia. You're so sweet. I know I bring them up a lot, but
they are so.
But
cute.
You know, it's funny when
no.
when you want to discipline. Like I find if I encourage, like if I compliment them and encouragement how great they do instead of point out what they did wrong, they want to do better. And it's just like us, like as adults. Like if you're you know stuck with like a substance abuse issue, it's like if you're not doing well and someone criticizes you, do you want to do better? No, you know, you don't want to do better. But if you're encouraged or you're met with some kind of empathy or I'm here with you, we'll figure this out, we'll get through this, right? Then you want to do better. So I think it's very parallel, this, you know, at like working, I mean, being with a toddler and being with an adult around doing better in life and, you know, But I was just going to say, so.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How does your work connect to parenting? I mean, and also obviously that's a subject matter that I am constantly reading up on because, you know, there's so many different phases when you're raising these kids.
There are. And in fact, what led me to write my book, The Child Code, is that I found myself raising the challenging child that I studied.
Ah, and, okay. I was wondering maybe if that was inspired
by
that.
Oh, Yes, yes. Highly impulsive, highly emotional. And so I found myself talking to my friends a lot about the research, because I, knowing the research was so helpful for me in my own parenting. And so, and what struck me was that I saw so many of my incredibly intelligent, competent, amazing friends who were constantly doubting themselves, or if their children were not being perfectly behaved, dreamy children, the type we all imagine having all the time, they were thinking, what am I doing wrong? Or if their child was struggling, what, you know, what's wrong with him? And so
right. That doesn't
that's
help,
where
right?
Yeah. I realized so much of the parenting information that is out there is, you know, focused on all the things we can do or should do as parents. And there's a lot of great information out there, but it almost wholly ignores what we know is one of the most important influences on kids' behavior, and that is their genes, that they all have their own little unique wiring. Their brains are literally wired differently by their unique genetic codes, and that by understanding what are their natural temperamental styles, we can make it much easier on ourselves because, you know, one, we can reduce the judgment and the blame and all the pressure we feel to, like, shape our kids from scratch. And secondly, certain types
be perfect.
Of kids, yeah, exactly, yes. Certain types of kids respond better to certain parenting strategies. So there's different things that you need to focus on depending on the characteristics of your child. And so, you know, that's what prompted me to write the child code, was that I feel like this is information that can be so helpful for parents and just isn't getting out there.
I'm ordering it. I'm ordering it today.
No, well, thank
that's
you.
Awesome.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's so true.
And, you know, I think people are just more generally interested in being parents now. I mean, you know, you see these things on, like, Facebook, like the 70s moms, like, you know, sent us out with, like, a cheese sandwich and a, you know, Coke in the morning and told us to be home at night. It wasn't really like that, but kind of, you know, like, I don't remember my parents being particularly interested in what I was doing. I mean, you know, they were, but I don't know. I just think people are just more focused. Yeah, they're more focused and they're, you know, paying attention.
And maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe because
we have.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I think some people too are like, you know, I mean, I'm an older, not older, but I had my first child at 39. So I did a lot of work on myself, awareness. I have more awareness. So I don't want to impose the same, you know, I think maybe pathways I went down onto them, or my own narratives that are unhealthy. You know, I've worked through them. I'm not going to impose that, or I'm going to hope not to. And I'm going to, you know, but with that being said, I think I put a lot of pressure on myself because I want to make sure that I'm, you know, attuning to them emotionally, making sure that they feel seen and heard, and making sure that I mirror, you know, good things to them, which does put pressure on. And then when they don't act perfect, they have a tantrum. You're like, uh-oh, what do I do? You know, but yeah.
Exactly. Yes, it's that's the story of many parents. In fact, you are correct that if you look at how much time we spend with our children and actively trying to shape and mold our children, it is, you know, it's grown exponentially over the last decades. And for good and for bad, like you said, one of the good things is that we are more attuned to our children. And, you know, we don't tend to default to, you know, many of the punitive parenting, parenting was much more common. And so those can be very good things. But the flip side is that it can also lead us to put a lot of pressure on ourselves. And so, what I try and do with my book is help parents. You know, the first part is a little bit about the science behind how genes influence kids' behaviors, how they influence the environments that those kids seek out, and how we can, you know, play a role in that process as parents. But then, you know, sort of the second half of the book, the meat of the book is really, you know, filling out little surveys so you can figure out where your kids fall on certain temperamental dimensions that play a big role in lots of important life outcomes that we care about, and then figuring out what sorts of parenting strategies work better or are more important to focus on for different types of kids. It's sort of the
I love that outlines
of,
it. Yeah, what a guide.
Precision medicine. You
so
know?
Good.
We can't do it
That's
all.
So
and
good.
Trial and error isn't good for any of us, right? We all get worn down by that process. So how can you kind of start to hone in on what your child needs?
Right, right. That's so great. The child code. We're going to order the child code. Yes, for sure. I'm just curious.
Absolutely.
What age do you?
I wish I had that.
I know. But what age do you think? Because I was kind of reading up on your on the different kinds of personalities, just very briefly. But what age can you? Like, I could see that my son's very. Very empathetic. He feels deeply. He gets very like he could get like crazy fiery, like in within 2 seconds, like rage, you know, or frustration really fast. And so, I know, but he's only three, so it's like you don't really know, you know, it's hard to kind of gauge their personality completely. But would this help for that age, you think, or what ages do you recommend?
It absolutely does. And
okay.
So, infants differ a ton, but that doesn't tend to be highly predictive of long-term outcomes, right? So just because you have a baby that cries all the time does not mean that you're going to have a teenager that
right,
yells at you all the time.
Right.
But temperament actually does start to solidify and show up in ways that are more consistent starting around 2 to 3, so in that toddler age range. And, you know, one of the things that yes, that we talk about is, you know, all kids get upset sometimes. All kids are going to, you know, be fearful sometimes, throw a fit sometimes. And so what you're really looking for are behavior patterns that are consistent, across time. So obviously, you know, the more time you spend with your child, the more you can start to, you know, see these
the
patterns.
Pattern, yeah.
And also that are consistent across places as well too. And so you were talking about your child being what we would call one of the big dimensions that I talk about is emotionality. So highly emotional kids, and I had one of those, they tend to be, you know, one of the more challenging temperamental dimensions for parents, because some kids are just wired to be much quicker toward fear, frustration, or distress. And so, you know, those are the kids that are coloring a picture 1 second and everybody's having fun. And then, you know, the next second my son would have like balled up the picture, thrown it on the floor, you know, and stormed out of the room. And you're like, what just happened? And, you know, I was like that as a child. So I could recognize, oh, the sky was not the right color of blue. So the whole picture was ruined. Right.
Right.
And, So, you know, some kids are just more prone to get to those really big feelings, to getting frustrated over what we might consider little things or, quote, over nothing. Of course, it's a big thing for them. And so there's certain parenting strategies that can work better for those kind of kids, because what, unfortunately, they tend to draw out of us is our wrath, right? It's not okay to suddenly slam the door or throw your shoe or, And those strategies just tend to make things worse, because you're now getting upset or imposing your will on your easily frustrated, easily upset child, which, you know, can spiral out of control in a way that's not good for anyone.
Exactly. I love that. I love that. Well, I love what you're saying, because it makes sense, and I definitely would do well learning a lot more about that. That's fabulous.
And, you know, drawing it back to addiction as well, you know, how I ended up going all the way down to little kids is that, you know, we talked about how some of these pathways that influence risk for addiction. So as we started to understand what are the ways that our genes make some of us more at risk, we realized, well, it's through these differences in the ways that our brains are wired to respond to reward, to how we handle, you know, our emotions and our fears. And those things, you know, show up very early in development. And the reason I think that's so important, and I actually spend a lot of time talking to parents, is because if we want to think about how do we prevent substance use problems, that a lot of it has nothing to do with the actual alcohol or drugs, the substances themselves. A lot of it
course.
Is
yeah.
how do you
right.
learn to manage these different you know, temperamental
emotions,
characteristics.
Right.
And
self-soothe
exactly,
or not.
Emotion
right.
regulation, self-regulation.
Yes.
Those kind of things.
Yes.
Yeah. And so how?
I'm just kidding.
That's the $64,000
question,
that's Erica.
That's the big question.
That's right. That's right.
So there are, you know, as you know, teaching kids coping skills, you know, how to manage their emotions, how to regulate their behavior. The good news is that time is on our side because as brains mature, we get better at regulating our behavior. But, you know, the bad news for us parents is that that self-regulation, that higher level thinking through consequences of our behavior as opposed to what we want right now is the last part to mature. So yes, there's a variety of different strategies though that are evidence-based and actually I walk through a number of them in my book. So there's kind of a step-by-step of like, here's a whole series of things you can work with your child on to help them develop those self-regulation skills from a young age so that now when they are, you know, adolescents and substances are coming on the scene, they have healthy coping skills and strategies and they aren't turning to substances in, you know, in unhealthy ways or as an outlet.
Well, what a gift you have given everybody with this book. So thank you.
Absolutely. And like you said, even if it does turn into addiction, hopefully in the future, you know, there's going to be a lot more rehabilitation than, you know, incarceration, which is a topic for another day. But thank you so much.
Another day. Yeah.
We could talk about this for hours, literally. I could, honestly. It's just so fascinating to me.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, Danielle, thank you so much for being with us today. I'm so grateful. You are such a gift.
Yes, it was
you
such
are
a
so
wonderful
brilliant.
Honor
well,
to have you here.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Sure.
I appreciate your kind words. And yes, I'm really looking forward to being a part of Rutgers now and further building out the Addiction Research Center so that we can, you know, all work together to make a difference to tackle these problems.
Good. Well, and we'll keep in touch. We'll keep in touch
absolutely.
With you for sure.
Absolutely. I would love that.
Danielle, where can everybody find you?
So my website is DanielleDick.com and the book website is thechildcode.com. And you can also follow me on social media at Dr. Danielle Dick, where I put out little snippets from the book and also write articles and blogs about topics related to child behavior, addiction, and mental health.
Good. I'm already following you. That's fabulous.
Me too.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
Yes, absolutely. Well, so Danielle, every week when Eric and I do this podcast, we always ask our guest what we call the deep dive question at the very end. And the deep dive question.
Oh, okay.
I know it sounds very ominous, right? And you have so many, but the deep dive question is, Danielle, what is your superpower?
I think it is connecting with people. And by that, I mean, and I'm going to revert back to, you know, one of the things that I love is not just generating research, but also working with other people to think about how can we get research out to people who can use it? How can we bring together people who are thinking about this from different angles and different perspectives and bring in community members and individuals with lived experience and connect them to researchers and connect researchers who work in different fields so you can cross-fertilize ideas. And I am also just a highly extroverted person, so I love meeting people and getting to know them and their stories. And so, yes, I think that might be my superpower.
Well, you are fantastic.
Fabulous.
Yes, absolutely.
That's a good one.
We can all be more connectors.
Well, thank you all for having me. I very much appreciate it.
And thank you again for being with us. And to our listeners out there, thank you for joining us. And until next week, be well.